You're listening to Limitless Mind, Limitless Body. This is the Understanding You series, episode 2. I'm John Swanepoel, joined again today by Paula Ralph and our guest, Terry Hewitt. Based in Tauranga, Terry teaches both nationally and internationally, primarily educating adults and teenagers on how to feel more pleasure in their lives. She's a certified sexological body worker, somatic sexuality educator, and embodied counselor. Today we're going to discuss how we've been conditioned. Hi, welcome back. This time, I'm with Paula again. Hi, Paula.
Hello, John.
Hi. And we've got to get a guest we're going to bring in shortly. And we'll be talking about conditioning today and just looking at various aspects of conditioning. So, how's your week been?
It's gone really fast.
Yeah.
Hey. Don't know where it went.
Fast in lockdown.
Yeah.
That's crazy. Hey.
Yeah.
So today we're going to talk about, the two aspects I usually look at with conditioning is do as you're told and give the right answer.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm.
And what are you going to look at?
Well, conditioning comes, it links into our beliefs as well.
Hey, absolutely.
And the way I see it is that when we are born, we are, to use a metaphor, we're like a little garden, and we are a garden of all this lovely fertile soil. Mm. And we get seeds dropped into our garden, and I'm gesturing here with the seeds dropping into the garden. And those seeds come from our parents, it comes from our teachers, from our church, from our state. And all those seeds are dropped in our garden, and in that lovely fertile soil they will grow, and they actually become what we believe in and what we think we should be believing in. And because they are seeds, we nurture those beliefs because we want them to grow and we want them to be right. So we look for evidence that our belief is right and correct and the way to do it. And then it's not until we get a whole lot of seeds growing in our lovely soil and we grow up and we start to go, hang on a minute, that why should I believe in that? Why should I have to think like that anymore? And that's when we start doing the old rebellious thing, if we want to. You don't have to, but a lot of people start questioning it. So, and then along comes a whole lot of other things in our life that challenge our belief, and we can take that opportunity to say, well, no, that doesn't actually fit for me, or it does. And letting go of one of those little seeds, one of those little plants, letting go, it is quite difficult sometimes. You know, when you yank a weed out of the garden, it's quite hard. It wants to hang on in there, and that's where cognitive dissonance starts happening, because it's not easy to turn your back on a belief. And to change your mind about what you think, because it is actually a whole body experience, not just something that goes on in your head. So we get to a stage where we can look at what we believe in or not. The problem is some of these things run, we are so good at running this pattern of the belief and making that belief fit that it turns into an unconscious behaviour and an unconscious pattern.
And a series of belief systems that don't work for you.
Absolutely.
Then, so I like to say right or wrong, good or bad. Yep. So when you make something right and good, then you start create, that's the foundation to the belief system.
Yes.
Or wrong or bad, same. But yep. The thing is, when we make something right or good, you stick yourself more than if you make something wrong or bad.
Yeah.
Okay. Because when we make something right, it's like, you know, it doesn't matter what you say, this is right, this is how it's going to be.
Yeah.
And I mean, you stick yourself too with making it wrong, because some people will stick to the, you know, the wrongness of something quite stubbornly.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not right or wrong, good or bad. I like to use what's light and what's heavy.
Yeah.
So if something's light for you, it's a truth for you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it's what doors going to open.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be nice and easy. It's going to be flowing. If something's heavy, it's a lie for you.
Yeah.
And there's always going to be a brick wall you're going to run into. Mm. And we kind of, how many times have we run into brick walls until we wake up, right?
Yeah, lots, yeah. And sometimes we don't.
Yeah, and so the conditioning also comes from the theta state as well. Mm-hmm. In the first 7 to 8 years of our life. And I like to describe that as download mode.
Which is when the soil is most prepared and ready.
Yeah. So everything we see, well, there's no conceptualization in that period. Everything we see, we hear, we experience is just downloaded.
Mm.
And then when we start to wake up, groups of people call it the Rubicon phase.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the more spiritual approach to that is, their description of that is, that's when you become fully incarnated in your body.
Right.
Become mm-hmm. fully grounded.
Yeah.
Yeah. Science, it says, well, you come out of the theta state.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
And you start to wake up. And then you start to, what we call biomimetic mimicry and biomimetric mimicry. So biomimetic mimicry is when we do the download.
Yeah.
So we download all the information, blah, 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 I've got it all there. Biomimetric mimicry is when we start mimicking everything that we've downloaded.
Yeah, and making it true.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And following along. But that's where the conflict comes with teenagers.
Mm-hmm.
Because teenagers start to really conceptualize and recognize the downloads that they've got aren't really how they want to be necessarily.
Yeah, why should I?
Yeah. And it's like, well, I want to be myself. So that's why they spend so much time on their own.
Mm.
They spend so much time mm-hmm. with their mates. You know, they're in their room.
Mm.
The circadian rhythm shifts by about an hour as well.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why they sleep later.
Mm-hmm.
And sleep longer in the day. They go to bed later and they sleep longer is because it's a natural shift.
Mm-hmm.
So it's allowing them the space to work out which part of the download they don't want to use and which part they do. But it's like you say, it's so embedded in the garden.
Yeah.
And it's like a network of roots that go in under the soil. And when you pull one, you know, it's still connected to and until we start really focusing on what we're doing. And awareness. Awareness is everything. Once we're aware of something, we can change it.
Which requires stepping back from yourself almost and watching yourself and observing yourself and saying, what did I think there and why did I think that?
Yeah.
And it's hard to step back from yourself sometimes.
It's also, the condition that we get is so powerful.
Mm.
And the do as you're told gives the right answer. I like to try and simplify things down, which is why I use a lot of computer analogies and how the body works, how we function, because people are used to that. They're used to that terminology and they understand the basic outline of how something's functioning. But, if we start with do as you're told, first 7 years of your life, you're downloading everything, do as you're told. And I don't know about, there's lots of schools overseas and all around the world that don't have uniforms, but the British-based colonial countries have uniforms that kids wear to go to school. So that's do as you're told. That's a condition.
Conformity by uniformity.
Yeah, conformity by uniformity. Turning up what time does school start? Be there.
Yeah.
Mm. When's your break time? Do that. I'm going to give you some information. You're going to learn it.
Yeah.
And then I'm going to ask you questions, and you have to give me the right answer, or you failed. You're a failure.
Mm.
Yeah.
So I have a lovely friend in Ireland, Liz Valua, and she talks to people. She's a teacher, and she talks to people about the good child syndrome. And how it is a syndrome of being good. Don't say what you want to say. Don't butt in. Don't have a voice. Yeah. Just be good. Just be likable.
Yeah.
And all will be well. Well, that's fine until that child is put into a situation where they are forced into doing something against their will and they continually suppress their voice. And that's when real problems can happen physically and mentally because they haven't been encouraged to speak up and to challenge the status quo of belief in their environment, which is, in her case, school.
And how many kids do you, thinking back when you were at school, how many kids do you recall getting told off or kicked out of the classroom because they were asking inappropriate, so-called inappropriate questions? You know, they're asking a question, but that's not the subject. So you're being disruptive.
Mm.
But when we think about it, that's just the human mind. The human mind isn't designed to learn linearly, which is why so many people find it difficult to take linear information in. and why the inquiry-based form of learning is becoming more and more popular nowadays, because, you know, we've got access to the internet. You've got, you know, you can ask, type a question and there's an answer, right?
And when you say that, I immediately think of when I go and look something up online, how does that feel? It's not just a logical thing. We relate it to how it feels from a previous experience. It's a feeling, and it's a whole bunch of bodily reactions and proteins and memory that has been set up to how does that feel going along with what I know.
Yeah.
Curiosity is the best thing ever.
It's cool.
You open yourself up for learning.
Well, both my kids have done the inquiry type process. I mean, my daughter, who's younger, first of all started, she'd been in a sort of a creative inquiry based education up until she went to high school, and when she got to high school she was excited to go to different classes because she wasn't used to that, and like 3 weeks later she was like, nah, I'm going back into inquiry. She could see the expansiveness of being able to ask questions, research, write about it, and stand up and present it.
And she felt that was being squashed.
Absolutely, yeah. Because it's linear. I mean, that's why there's a guy named Tony Buzan years and years ago in the 80s. He wrote a few books on mind mapping and, you know, drawing pictures and creating visual contexts on a piece of paper to help you remember information. And the reason it works so well is because you're creating more than one pathway to
and
a piece of information.
We love pictures in our brain.
Absolutely. That's a lot of how we function.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And giving the right answer is just, it's polarizing. And that's why so many people struggle, because they're waiting to be told what to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they're not sure that the answer they've got is the right thing. So it's two steps forward, one step back, you know, unless you're just willing to throw everything to the wind and follow what feels light.
Mm-hmm.
What is your truth?
And I can say in my whole career I have believed seriously in the voices that have guided me. I've trusted them, higher collectives and higher groups than me. And in my career as a pharmacist, I did as I was told. I just towed the line, but there was some serious internal questioning going on, as in, like, this just doesn't make sense. I don't get it. It wasn't cool to question that, but it stayed with me. And now I can see that those voices that I did trust, I'm not actually able to trust them anymore. So I was sitting on the fence, knowing that something wasn't really quite right, but not knowing why I should be questioning that, because I just implicitly, blindly trusted groups.
And that's so cool, because the question is the key.
It is.
You know, and going,
there was a lot of years of questioning.
Well, going back to the, you know, our last podcast, you know, we looked at the analogy of the game console being the body and the infinite part of you, and that there isn't anything the infinite doesn't know. And so the most powerful thing we do is ask questions without trying to find the right answer.
Yeah.
Instead of trying to give the right answer the whole time. There is no right answer. There's just an answer that's going to work for you or not.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So if you ask a question without trying to find the right answer, an answer is going to come to you, because you know it's written, it's a universal law, ask and you will receive.
Mm-hmm.
So you ask that question, what do I need to perceive, know, be and receive with ease?
With ease and grace.
Today.
Yeah.
That will help create awareness around this particular problem, or who do I need to meet? What else am I not aware of that I haven't learned? What else do I need to learn? Can I have that information with ease, please? Always ask with ease.
With ease, yeah.
Yeah. What's the only thing that should be hard in life?
Don't say it.
The only thing that should be hard in life is a penis.
At appropriate times, hopefully.
You know? And let's be honest, you know, a penis doesn't want to be hard for too long, because that gets painful.
But again, there's some more conditioning that you've just thrown in. Conditioning is that a penis should be hard.
Yeah.
No, that's right.
That's an excellent segue to say hi to Terry.
That was the perfect segue, wasn't it?
Hi, Terry. Welcome, Terry Ewan. Tell us a bit about yourself.
I am a Semitic sexuality educator, which in some circles I actually just say I have the ability, I'm certified to touch people's genitals if that's a valuable or useful thing for them to have happen. So I support people to learn about sex and intimacy and pleasure. Mm. And so, but the basis of what I do is, interestingly enough, actually tacks onto the conversation that you've just had, and it's about the biggest thing that I try and encourage people to do is learn about how they feel and use their curiosity to do it. Mm. If we use our curiosity, we're staying out of judgment, we're staying out of expectation. You mentioned it's a great learning zone for those reasons. Yeah. But we've been so conditioned to believe this cognitive space that we dwell in. Mm. That's our condition. That we've put all of this importance on our brain, and effectively our brain is really just a modulator for what's going on in our body. Our brain is just taking in the information from our body, it's running it through all of our brain devices, and it's spitting out our reaction to it. And then so what we've forgotten to do, we've actually forgotten how to feel and how to feel the light, how to feel the ease in our life.
Feel the truth.
And so, a lot of my work, if I'm working with people that are having challenges within their sexuality and intimacy and pleasure, then that's what we're looking for. We're looking for the light. We're looking for the ease. Mm. But because of all of that conditioning that's been loaded on us, sometimes those desires are seen as negative and shameful. And so there's huge pieces that we're kind of trying to unwrap with people. Mm. That's part of my work, is working with people with challenges, and then the other part is actually educating and putting an open, inclusive, consent-based view of sexuality out there.
So you do a workshop called 50 Shades of Green.
Yes, I do.
And I've done that workshop.
You have? And how did you find that workshop, John?
And that audio show was awesome.
Yeah.
And just really... A real opportunity to decondition,
mm.
yeah? and to step out of the wrongness of sex,
mm.
you know, and the this Victorian and before rigidity in thinking around sex and sexuality.
Mm. Yeah,
you know, sexuality isn't copulation. Sexuality is how we present ourselves to the world, how we walk down the street,
mm-hmm.
you know, how we interact with people around us.
Mm.
And how we want to be seen, how we like to be seen.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the copulations is copulation, you know.
Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. You
know, yeah, it's fun, but it's not about the sexuality, mm-hmm. is it?
Yeah, but we've made pleasure a dirty word in our society.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
You know, pleasure for pleasure's sake, or pleasure indeed.
Yeah.
You know, we value busyness and people that are rushing around and but there's so we've kind of devalued pleasure in a way, and it's not taught about in our schools. It's not openly discussed within our family units. The church frowns upon it. So it's just it's that place where we've conditioned, and partly conditioned because it's a great way of controlling people.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know.
Yeah, and that's the do as you're told, give the right answer. That's the manipulation and control that we're seeing now around the world. You know, the hesitation, the fear that's being created.
Mm-hmm.
I have three things, three points that I always give to people to go and work with. And I think that it's the wrongness of ourselves and our being. You know, don't do that. That's dirty.
Mm.
You know, how many times have you heard that? Dirty. I bumped into someone that trains in my gym today. And abductor, they've got a little abduction and adduction machine for the hips, right?
Mm-hmm.
And she described it as the naughty exercise and the good exercise. You know, being naughty is opening your legs, and being good is closing your legs.
Mm-hmm.
And it was said in a lighthearted joke kind of way, but it was, you know, we were discussing the quality of the gyms in Tauranga, mm-hmm. and that this particular one is best equipped in the city, and she mentioned the couple of the machines that she hadn't noticed other gyms had, you know,
mm-hmm.
and that was one of them, but it was her description of that.
Mm-hmm.
So I say to people, I like to chunk things down because, you know, one, two, three, many. So if we can remember just three points,
mm-hmm.
And I say the first thing is what someone says to you and how they behave towards you is their shit.
Mm-hmm.
So if their staff is kind and loving and supportive, then you want more of that in your life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. If their stuff is a disregard, yeah, a manipulation, and a subtle abuse or major abuse, you don't need to receive that. Okay, but it's their stuff. So just remember that how they behave and what they say to you is their stuff. Number two, what someone thinks about you is none of your business. That's an easy one, because we don't know. Yeah. And that's where 50 Shades of Green comes in, because it's about being open and having the confidence to communicate. Yeah. And the third one is, and the most important is, don't make yourself wrong. And that's the most difficult one to really get your head around, because we're so focused on the story that's happening in front of us and the emotional reaction that's created, that it overrides the percentage or the component of us making ourselves wrong. So you can't really go into a mega reaction, negative reaction, without having a component of that story where you're making yourself wrong.
Sometimes you don't recognise it because that seed in the garden runs so deep.
Yeah, absolutely.
You just can't see it, the wood for the trees. And sometimes that's where it helps to be curious as to what others see in you.
So in your workshop, you talk about vulnerability.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah, vulnerability is one of those key Brené Brown words that is, you know, she's done wonders for people's emotional intelligence. She's given the wording around it. And so it is, it's about encouraging people to show up and be vulnerable, but it's also about teaching people how to respectfully deal with that vulnerability as well. So part of the workshop's asking for what you want, being in touch with your desires.
Mm.
The other part of the workshop is actually about being able to say yes to that or a respectful no to that.
Mm.
But it's always got to come from a drug and alcohol free kind of vulnerable place in your body. It's about creating intimacy from those places, because if you can get to those places, it's going to be a far deeper, more incredible space than not. So,
and to the extent you make yourself wrong, you just can't go there
necessarily. No, you can't.
Without drugs and alcohol.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. Yeah. Yep.
That's a wrongness in its own right.
Yeah, I mean, I was really lucky. I had a beautiful, I lost my virginity in a wonderful way, but I was one of the very few amongst my peers, and most people were just, we're doing it because we want to do it, or we want to tick it off the bucket list and we need to go and get smashed. And it's like my experience was just so different and so lovely, because it was totally conscious, it was slow, it was just, delightful. But we're kind of stripping that away from people, and I think more and more and more, because our kids are, porn's really, really accessible, so they've got all these wild ideas about what it should look like, and they haven't been given the communication skills in order to ask for what they want, and neither have they been given the skills to actually feel what they want. So we're just, the pressure on them is becoming more and more, I feel.
Mm.
And there's kids out there that are making really bad decisions. Well,
the lie of porn.
Yeah, yeah.
Because at the end of the day, it's just a lie.
Absolutely, yeah. But our children don't have the cognitive ability to understand that. They don't have the experience. They don't have the felt experience. Neither do they have
not even sure if it's just kids. I think I see adults that have been affected by it seriously.
Absolutely,
as well.
Yeah. And it's not just the men. The problem is that it's not just our men. The men are definitely the first victim in that piece, but it's then the people around them, and particularly those people that are intimate.
Yeah.
There's beautiful, lovely, successful people, and it's like, I can't have sex with my partner because he's addicted to porn.
Desensitization.
Absolutely, it's huge. Yeah, and it's starting younger and younger, and that's the that's the really scary thing. But again, it's another form of conditioning. We have our young women watching it to see what's expected of them, and we have our young men watching it so that they know what to do and what it should look like.
Mm.
And it's just,
kind of, it's been quite open in some of the European countries for many years, and they just have a different attitude towards sex, especially the kids.
Yeah, yeah. But the attitude becomes from the families that they've been raised in and the culture that they've been raised in, and we don't have that here. You know, seeing a naked body in New Zealand, they're like, oh, my God. So how do you have a healthy sexuality if we've sexualized our view of human bodies? It's challenging.
That's what I loved about going to the Canaries.
Yeah.
You could walk around however you liked.
Yeah.
People were fully clothed, no clothes, or partly clothed, and it was...
Yeah.
Was really free.
Mm.
It was
okay.
Very freeing.
Yeah. Mm. I usually, when I'm working with people, say, you know, where's the wrongness of the clothing? Because a lot of people will go into a bathroom,
mm-hmm.
right, shut the door,
mm-hmm.
take their clothes off.
Mm.
The bathroom then becomes their clothes.
Mm.
They're not naked beneath their clothing. Their clothing is a guard, is a way of keeping them hidden.
Mm.
And so one of the really good therapy for people that are in that place is to go and sit on a nudist beach naked.
Mm. Mm.
Go to a nudist resort or a nudist con, you know, place for a day. We have one just locally. Yeah. This is fantastic.
Yeah, it's a great.
Go and hang out there and just be comfortable in who you are. Because, to be honest, no one cares.
Mm. Yeah, but for some people that's the
huge hurdle.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. There's no way in hell that anyone could you know, I've got friends and there's no way in hell that they could get there because of their belief system.
Yeah, it's just
to the extent they can't do that.
No.
That's how much they make themselves wrong.
Mm, mm.
Yeah. And that's how much they've been made wrong.
Mm, mm.
Yeah. And I remember doing that. I remember when I was a 3-year-old. A very vivid, very vivid memory. And I must admit, I was very little. And because there was still, so I might have even been younger, they were those little divan rails that you can have that slot in between the mattress and the base,
mm-hmm.
right? And this was an hour, I was brought up in Africa, right? And I remember there, and I woke up, you know, and it's afternoon sleep, and I had this little stiffy, and I was really proud. And I was like, look at that. Yeah. You know,
look what I've done.
And I remember my mum came in, I went, check it out. She went, naughty.
Oh my goodness. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I was like, oh.
Yeah.
Don't feel naughty to me.
Yeah.
you know? But then it was like, oh, right, okay. Well, you know, I mustn't do that.
Yeah.
And it's like, I just really made a point with my son to, you know, let yourself go, mate.
Mm.
Mm-hmm.
And you just, I never made his body wrong. And I hadn't learned this stuff because, you know, I'd come from physio and acupuncture. So I hadn't learned the consciousness stuff. And going into psychoneuroimmunology, it was, I started that in 2005, the year my daughter was born. And so a couple of years later, I'd done all this, you know, the brain work and the stuff that we mentioned last week on the 24 traits we have in common with lizards and things. Mm-hmm. You know? And so it was really important that my kids were comfortable in their bodies. So when my daughter was about 2, we would come out of the shower and stand in front of the mirror and she'd be learning all the body parts and it would be perfect nose,
mm-hmm.
perfect mouth, perfect ears. Mm-hmm. And she loved it.
Mm-hmm.
It was too late for my boy because
mm-hmm.
he was 4.
Mm.
And you know, Connor, come do this. No way.
He's off.
Yeah. And he was off.
Yeah.
But you know, if you get kids young enough, and now she's really comfortable in herself,
mm-hmm.
and doesn't make herself wrong in that way.
Yeah, yeah. My son was he was dying to go through puberty, and so he would look every day, twice a day. He'd be looking under his arms, and you know, it's like anything today, Taylor? Nah, nothing today, Mum. Okay, well, then, you know, and the excitement, you know, when we found the first one, it was like, you know, but yeah, it was something that I consciously watered because it was part of, you know, and it was the same thing. And then it happened with his pubic hair. He's like, I've got one, Mum. I'm like, yeah, you know. It was something that we really, really celebrated for exactly that reason. Yeah. It was like, I didn't want to come at it from that angle. So it's like, well, how do we come at it from a different angle? What's the opposite of that conditioning? Yeah. And it was to celebrate it and to make it really exciting. So
and that's it. We've got to smash this bullshit conditioning.
Mm.
And it's nobody's fault. You know, it's been handed down through generations. Yes,
yeah, absolutely.
And every parent did their best with what they had.
Absolutely, mm-hmm. yeah.
And it's okay. But now it's time, okay, what awareness can we create around this? And how much more ease can we have with our bodies?
Yeah.
And you know, there's nothing wrong with bodies. There's nothing wrong with you being attracted to someone else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In whatever level that is, you know, you've had some experiences too. The other thing that I do a lot of work with is actually injuries caused by that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, injuries caused by the overprocessing of consciousness, belief systems, and aspects in the body. So we look at the every part of the body has a responsibility to help process different levels of consciousness, as well as having a physiological and anatomical structure and function. When it comes to sexuality issues, and the majority of injuries happen around L3 in the lumbar spine, and in the pelvis, so around the sacrum, the coccyx, the uterus, the genitals, and the ovaries for women, and the prostate for men. And it's around fear of ridicule and fear of rejection. And that is driven by the liver meridian, which encircles the genitals. So the liver meridian on the right-hand leg comes up and crosses over and goes up the left-hand side of the body and vice versa. So it's like encapsulating the genital area. And so for women, it's also ridicule and fear of ridicule and rejection for the genitals, but also about acceptance, uterus. And so prostate is about acceptance because it's a similar consciousness set of headings as the uterus. So what that means is if people are, if there's a, they've been brought up with this ridicule or rejection of body from as a biometric mimicry of the parents, so how they cover themselves up and tell you what you should and shouldn't do and who you mustn't show them that, and you know, you must always cover yourself up because, you know, it's dirty. It's not right.
Yeah.
Then every time they, you know, every time they have an experience in life, then there's this fear of ridicule, fear of rejection going on. It just means that we recognize that that's a part of the body that helps to process that and dissipate that fear or that charge, or the worry, the anxiety around that. And when an area gets overprocessed, when it gets overused, it gets tired just like anything else. And then that's where there's a disruption in that part of the body. And so there's always a consciousness component that needs to be addressed when there's serious illnesses in different areas or injuries that just don't go. You know, they just keep recurring.
Why would a perfectly good body decide to throw up an illness or an injury when we're supposed to be rebuilding our bodies and ourselves all the time? Why would a perfectly good body go, nah, I'm going to get your attention and do something random?
Yeah, absolutely.
That's it.
It's kind of like what comes up for us, because we use biofeedback, so we muscle test. So it's like a conversation with the subconscious, and what comes up is pathways that people create that incorporate those parts of the body, and it's like an emotional dissipation pathway that lets the emotion shoot down and get dissipated through the system, so you don't have to deal with it openly and outwardly.
Yeah.
And it's disruptive. And I also like Bruce Lipton's work on biology of beliefs. So how a cell will the way the cell functions is directly associated to how its environment is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so if your body's in a specific environment, then those parts of the body, collection of cells, being the prostate, for instance, or the uterus or the ovaries or something, you know, their function will be disrupted. So again, I like the analogy of a cell or an organ is an endocrine has a microchip. The membrane of it's like a microchip that holds a software program of how it should function.
Yeah.
And if the software program's disrupted or corrupted, then there's going to be some problems. It's not going to function properly. It doesn't have the right information.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of.
Which is kind of brings me back to a massive question I had. I believed completely in germ theory for viruses, and this COVID thing has really made me question what I believed in, the germ theory, because I came across this theory of exosomes. And it's like, what the hell's an exosome? And suddenly, this was my latest belief that just peeled away. It was like, oh my God, I don't know what to believe in now. My whole
career has been based on germ theory. Mm. Now this exosome theory's come up. What the hell? And it really put me in a spin for a little while until I figured it out. And now it's like, oh yeah, I get it. It's both.
But that feeling of undoing
a really, really strong belief
put
me into quite a spin for a couple of days. Mm. And it was only that.
Mm. And that goes back to, do as you're told, give the right answer in medical school.
Yeah.
You know, do as you're told, this is the syllabus. We're not changing it.
Mm.
Okay, we're not going to incorporate this subject group or that subject group or that subject group.
Yeah.
This is what you have to learn. We're going to ask you questions on it at the end. You're going to give us the right answer. Then you can get letters before your name and after your name.
Which means you are.
Yeah. And then these guys go into it 100% wanting to help humanity and really help people and make a difference.
Mm.
And so they take in the information, they work their asses off for 7 years, they come out with a doctorate and they go out and help people. But there's some holes missing.
And we don't know what we don't know.
Mm. Exactly right. Yeah.
We don't know that we were supposed to ask. We don't know that we could have asked.
Well, we don't want to ask because we don't want to be wrong. To so we don't want to ask the wrong question. Let's face it, because of the do as you're told and give the right answer, most people ask questions to confirm the answer they've got in their head is the right one.
With their bias,
Not because they actually need information they don't have.
Mm-hmm.
And when I did my degree in physiotherapy, I could look back and honestly say it was self-taught.
Mm-hmm.
Because you were given, this is the chat, you know, this is these are the parts of the body we're going to study this week, go away and learn it, come back, ask you questions on what you learned. Right, okay, I'm going to do the next lot.
Okay.
There was the only subjects we were really taught, the manual stuff was really good because, you know, you actually get your hands on and learn about the body that way. Anatomy is anatomy. Physiology was taught really well, though, to an in-depth level. And it was actually taught to you.
We need that.
You know? But a lot of it, I don't believe, I think it was the way the people in charge at the time were teaching. I don't think physio is taught that way everywhere.
Mm.
It's just in the school I'm attending. I used to sit there thinking, you're not teaching me anything. I'm going away and learning this for myself.
You're not supposed to be believing that.
So
I'm just wondering, when you work with people with their belief in sex, when that belief is challenged and opened, how do they feel about that? Is it a... is it a painful, or is it an excitement, or is it a... How do they deal with it?
A lot of the time, the very first feelings that come up are what you've just described, that being really wobbly. It's because it's something that's in the process of changing. It's not something they've actually felt yet. It's something that's moving, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So they kind of actually feel like... They feel wobbly.
Like almost. The carpet's being pulled from under their feet.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's like, well, okay.
No,
and so then they have to process that, not only in their brain but also in their body. It's about keeping people in their learning zone, as opposed to something that I call the freak the fuck out zone, because you can, you know, when you pull the rug completely out of someone, they're like, what the hell is going on?
Yes.
So it's actually about keeping them in a zone where it's slightly uncomfortable, but they can deal with it, if that makes sense. And so it's just about opening that door, and it's not about me opening the door, it's about that process of holding them so they can, so I'm kind of standing behind them as they open their own door up.
Yeah.
But they're only opening it up to places that they can deal with at the same time. So I work with the body a lot, so it's about anchoring in those new beliefs or those new feelings or that new thought pattern, and how we use the body to do that as well, not just thinking cognitively about things. It's like, actually, how do I anchor that feeling? What feeling do I get by opening that door? Where's the opportunity? Where's the curiosity? And then finding a way to anchor that feeling into the body.
Well, when you said before about all the body having the information, it's been shown that 80% of the messages that whiz around our whole body and head actually come from the body.
Yeah, 80% of our communication. And only 20%
go down to the body. Yeah. So the body's really, really important.
Absolutely.
You can't just read about it and go, oh, yeah, I get it. It's a felt sense.
Mm. Yeah, it is. And it's, you know, I can tell people who have pretty stunning lives, because, you know, I can tell that they can feel their bodies. It's, you know, I've got friends that are always consistently making terrible decisions, or you know, they're always finding themselves in the same stuff. And then there's other people that kind of just easily guide their way through their life, and it's very much they can feel things a lot more. They feel when it's not the right thing to do,
and they also feel what they ignored when they made a bad decision.
It's those voices. You know, I was just saying before before we started, I had a voice this morning telling me that I should have emailed something through, and I ignored it. And lo and behold, I got here and I'd forgotten the piece of paper. But for me, it was those little words in my head. But sometimes it shows up as an image or a feeling
or an action.
But it's about learning to, and you notice them when you don't listen to them mostly. Mm. But when you do listen to them, like I do most of the time, you don't notice them because you're always just following that.
It's full of ease and it's open. Full of grace.
It is. I turned around like 2 minutes down the road when I was coming here this morning, because I had an awareness that I'd left the back door open. Unlocked. It wasn't open. Yeah. It was unlocked. So I went and I was like, did I? So I went back and had a look, and it was. Mm. It was unlocked.
I turned around a few times because I got lost. And I just knew I was lost.
But yeah, it has to be when someone's choosing to look at something that's a really big belief or a really conditioned pattern, it has to be done really slowly in most cases. Something that you don't wanna, you know, you don't wanna really push someone into. Everything I do, the people are just, I'm just standing beside them holding, and they're just taking those steps at the level that works for them.
This is what I feel we're at in this time at the moment, over the last, well, this year, with believing that we can inherently trust those who guide us with our health, governments, organisations on a global scale. We have been taught to trust those with blind trust, and to come to the conclusion that maybe we can't trust them with blind trust anymore, that they changed but we didn't keep up with that news. I feel that's where we have to do this gently, or else people will just crumble.
Mm. Yeah, it's the conditioning, eh? Mm. And people are comfortable in their lives, going about their lives.
Yeah.
No, it's not going to affect
them
too much.
It doesn't pain me or hurt me, I'm fine. I'll carry on, thanks.
I had that conversation with my flatmate the other day, you know, it's like, and she just said, it isn't going to make any difference to me. I'm going to get up and go to work and then come home and live my life, but is it going to make any difference to me?
Yeah.
And I'm like, yeah.
Yeah, you got to think bigger than just
me.
You got to think bigger than just my job.
Otherwise, it just shuts you down.
Yeah. But that's my belief.
Well, it's okay. If you're listening and you would like to find out a little bit more about what Terry does, we'll stick a link up to her website for you so you can contact her. And I'm sure she'd be delighted to hear from you. Same with Paula, we'll stick your website up.
Thank you.
And mine will be up there too if you want to chat or connect with us. If you've got any comments, I'll put up an option to record some comments, and we can answer those, send those through to you guys if it's addressed to either Terry or Paula.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll look forward to next week. Thanks so much for coming along, guys. It's been awesome having you.
Thanks.
See you in a week.
Cheers.
See you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Limitless Mind, Limitless Body, the Understanding You series, episode 2. Thanks for joining us. I'm John Swanepoel. If you would like to find out more about the subjects discussed in this podcast, or would like to contact one of the practitioners, their details will be in the About This podcast section below. Look forward to catching up with you next week. Thanks for listening.